Chastain was lying, probably about many things. The smart thing to do was walk away. But Jack's interest was piqued. What was the game here? He'd come a long way, the money was good, and he felt a need to see this through. He closed his eyes and took a deep breath. The air was different here, heavier than New York's. Manhattan was old, and he'd found ancient secrets in its hidden corners. But this place, the atmosphere was laden with a rot of dark mysteries, with maybe even a touch of magic hovering on the edges. Jack had seen magic. He hated magic. "Be prepared for deadly force." Jack was hoping to avoid that, but he'd be ready. Michael Quinn stood flat against the side of the Boudreaux vault in the family cemetery of the Chastain plantation, listening. His ears were attuned to hear the faintest rustle of movement. A sliver of moon cast meager light, but that didn't stand against him. He had learned the art of seeing by night. The vault was filled top to bottom with decaying coffins or the sun-cremated dead, so he couldn't hide inside. Besides, the door was sealed. The Boudreaux family had long ago left the area, and it was doubtful that the vault would ever be unsealed, but he had no interest in the Boudreaux family tonight. Still, he hadn't been desperate enough to forget all sense and wait inside the Chastain mausoleum. The crumbling old Boudreaux vault was adorned with gargoyles and angels, strange mix that it might be, and a good place to wait. In the darkness, if a piece of his head showed as he watched the night, he might appear to be simply part of a gargoyle. The Chastain mausoleum had a gate and a door, and a chapel inside filled with an altar and chairs. The walls themselves were lined with coffins. Two sarcophagi stood to each side of the chairs that allowed seating. While the old Chastain plantation had burned to the ground during the Civil War, the family had merely moved on into the city of New Orleans, and every decade or so, a new Chastain joined his or her ancestors. He knew the mausoleum well. He'd come out here often enough in his misspent youth with friends. Adolescents loved to sneak out to the ruins of the Chastain plantation and into the old cemetery to tell ghost stories and try to scare themselves and dare one another to sleep in the mausoleum. They were somewhat outside the French Quarter and the old section of the city, where the time-worn buildings and Spanish and French architecture ruled in the unique and beautiful aura of faded elegance that created the atmosphere of New Orleans. Far from the jazz bands and commercial pop that emanated from the clubs on Bourbon. Yet here, out in the Bayou area, Michael felt even more a part of the essence of Orleans Parish. Here the cicadas were rubbing their wings. He heard the rustle of the wind through skeletal trees that scattered the graveyard, and beneath the meager glow of the moon, he felt the pervasion of death and history, and something lonely and sad as well. The cemetery was not the size of St. Louis, but was built in the true style of the cities of the dead that were so much a part of the South Louisiana landscape. Eerie by night, the small and large tombs did seem to make up their own city, and it was easy to imagine that ghostly denizens might emerge from the wrought iron gates and different archways and openings at any minute, ready to dance beneath the sliver of moonlight. The vigil seemed long. The tomb he leaned against seemed cold despite the sultry weather of the night. His muscles began to tighten. There. Movement. Quinn saw someone in dark clothing, almost invisible in the night, moving like a wraith. he appeared to slip through the iron gate and the giant wooden doors of the structure. They must have been left ajar. How? By whom? Quinn waited, damning the fact that his own heartbeat seemed loud in the night. He watched. He'd seen only one person. He'd begun his vigil almost 2 hours early to see who would come. He didn't head across the overgrown path to the front of the vault. He knew it well. Hell, he'd slept in the damn thing. The Chastain dead were apparently not vengeful. Nothing had happened to him. And, oddly enough, he could be grateful now that he did know the vault so well. He knew of a small entrance at the back, behind the altar. Apparently, one of the Chastain founding family members had liked to enter unobserved and mourn his dead. Quinn hurried around as quickly as he could, ever watchful of the front. Nothing. Coming to the rear, he took his time, barely breathing as he carefully pried open the rear iron door, praying it wouldn't screech. No one had used it in some time, but the vines and weeds that should have nearly choked it had been pulled away. Something was off here, but still, he was sure he could use this passage to get the jump on whoever was inside. He eased the door open just wide enough to get his body through. He dropped and rolled behind the altar as quickly as he could. The rear wall offered broken stained glass windows, and the weak illumination of the moon came through what remained of the colored glass in a strange purple color. The air smelled musty, but no surprise there. A tile tilted under his left shoe. Had the intruder hidden back here? If so, where was he now? Something within Quinn wanted to investigate that tile, pry it up. Later. He held his breath and listened. No sound. Not even the other's breathing. Was he holding his breath too? No. The mausoleum felt empty. But how could that be? Quinn had seen him go in. Pulling his revolver, he moved out from behind the altar and crept around, searching. The place was empty, but that was impossible. A sudden flurry of movement stunned him. Someone moving with lightning speed, hurtling toward him. Quinn spun around, but something cold and metallic rammed, none too gently, against the base of his skull. Another move and your brainstem comes out your nose. The pistol's muzzle was positioned to do just what the intruder said, so Quinn froze, cursing himself. He had played just about every role known to man in life, from idiot hero addict to cop, and now investigator of the unusual. And he wasn't accustomed to being the one taken by surprise. But hell, he'd also learned how to talk and stall, how to retreat to fight again. And this seemed the right time for that. Okay. Okay. The other man snickered as he removed Quinn's revolver from his grasp. Some hitman. The words stunned Quinn. What? What did you say? You heard me. You called me a hitman? On your knees. Got a little hog-tying to do. Wait just a goddamn minute. Who do you think I am? That Lady de Medici's boy. Now on your knees, or I put your own slugs through them. Madame de Medici, Quinn thought. He thinks I work for her? I've had no contact with the madam, ever. I don't know where you got your information, but I was hired by the owner, Jules Chastain. He could feel the other man stiffen behind him. Bullshit. No, true shit, he spoke quickly. Reach into my jacket pocket for my ID. My name is Michael Quinn. I'm a private investigator in New Orleans. The muzzle pressed harder against his skull, as the man reached around, found the folder, and removed it. "It's too dark to read in here anyway."
"You mean you came without a flashlight?"
"No."
His tone was annoyed.
"It's just that my hands are full at the moment."
He shoved Quinn toward the chairs.
"Have a seat while I figure this out."
Quinn did as he was told. The guy seemed dangerous, but Quinn felt no fear of him.
Odd. It was occurring to him that they'd both been taken. He hoped it was occurring to the other guy, too. A flashlight glowed, and Quinn caught a glimpse of some nondescript features, then the beam shone straight into his face.
This could be fake.
Quinn held up a hand to shield his eyes.
Yeah, it could be, but it's not.
The ID folder sailed through the light and landed in his lap.
I don't know why I believe you, but I do.
Why did Chastain hire you?
To protect this place from a thief he was tipped was coming?
That would be you, I guess. Quinn winced inwardly. It had seemed like a nothing job. He hadn't even told Danny about it. Chastain was rich. He and Danny often needed hefty sums in their line of work. Pulling in a nice, upfront paycheck for a few hours of work while she was busy with a celebration ceremony had seemed like a damn good idea. He should have known there'd be a catch, like nearly getting his fool self killed. The other man barked a bitter laugh.
"No, I'm no thief. Chastain hired me to retrieve a ring he had hidden here."
"What?"
"Yeah, what the fuck?"
The silence lengthened between them until Quinn finally said, "Can I have my pistol back?"
"It's a revolver, and a revolver is not strictly a pistol."
Quinn had to laugh. "You mean I let a gun nerd get the drop on me?"
"Facts is facts. And no, you can't have it back. At least not yet."
"Not yet is okay. But how the hell did you get the drop on me?"
"Chastain told me about the rear door. I didn't trust him, so I went in the front and out the back, then watched the place. I saw you go in the back, so I followed."
Quinn had to admit that was pretty clever, even as he kicked himself for falling for it. He'd seen how the vines at the rear had been disturbed, but he'd come in anyway.
"You do realize we've been set up, right?"
Another short, sharp laugh.
"You think?" "I knew this smelled bad."
"You don't sound like a local."
"Got that right. Chastain told me to be prepared for deadly force. He made it sound defensive. Now I'm thinking he wanted me to use it. What's he got against you?"
"Nothing that I know of. Barely know the man.
But I do know him better than you. I'm local."
"You know my name. What's yours?"
"Jack."
"Jack what?"
"Just Jack'll do. Seems like I was supposed to kill you."
Quinn's muscles tightened, ready to leap. He'd actually been declared dead once already. He didn't fear death, but he sure as hell didn't want to die.
"And?" he asked flatly.
A shrug. "Don't see any reason to."
Jack pulled out a folded piece of paper and handed it to Quinn.
"This is supposedly where Chastain hid the ring I was supposed to bring him. Suppose it's bogus, too."
Quinn looked over the diagram and the instructions.
"Don't you want a light?" Jack said.
"Don't need it."
Quinn studied the diagram.
"There should be a jagged little crack in the bottom of the first vault, the oldest, according to this."
He ignored the fact that the other man had a gun while he still didn't, and chanced turning his back on him to head to the rear of the vault and hunker down. He looked at the diagram again and stuck his hand into the jagged crack on the lowest shelf, that of Antioch Chastain, founder of the clan.
As the diagram suggested, his hand hit a box, a wooden box. He withdrew it, along with a mass of spider webs and bone dust. He looked at Jack and then opened the box. "Empty," they announced together. "Figures," Jack said. The whole thing was a setup. But why? He wanted us both here for a reason. Why here? And by the way, haven't you folks heard of graves? Quinn laughed. "The water table's too high. And actually, the cemeteries were conceived during the Spanish rule, and their design is according to the custom of the time. Good custom here. Bury someone and you could find their coffin floating along in the next heavy rain." "So you pigeonhole them in these little buildings? Doesn't it get ripe after a while? And what happens when you run out of shelves?" "Here in Louisiana, the rule is a year and a day. The heat is so great that bodies mostly cremate in that time. These tombs are like ovens. Families shovel the bits and bones of the remains of one loved one to a mutual holding section at the foot of the shelf so that another family member can find his or her resting place for a year and a day, or until the shelf is needed again." "That's gross. What country is this?" "The United States of Louisiana. We have our own way of doing things." "I guess you do." Jack looked around. "Great setting for a horror film, though. Hey, you think that's why he got us here? To film us fighting? Some sick YouTube snuff vid? You think he's hidden a camera? He didn't fly me down from New York so we could have this nice little chat. Gotta be some reason he put us both here." Quinn didn't see a camera anywhere, but memory of the loose tile flashed through his head. "It's probably nothing, but..." He ducked behind the altar and pried up the tile. Only dirt beneath it, but soft dirt. He dug and struck metal within the first inch. He worked his fingers around it and came up with a bracelet made of strange metal and carved with even stranger designs. A green stone the size of a dime was embedded in its center. It looked familiar. "I know this piece, the Sid Sev Nalesso."
"Sounds like a gelato flavor," Jack said.
"It was found sealed in a sunken temple dedicated to an as-yet unidentified deity in the drowned city of Heraklion."
"So, what's it doing here?"
"Good question. It and part of a papyrus scroll found with it were smuggled out and sold on the black market. The buyer was purportedly Chastain."
"And you know all this how?" Quinn hesitated. "I'm a private investigator, and I've been a cop for the city of New Orleans, but these days..."
He held off. He was always careful, especially with strangers, and more especially New Yorkers. But to his great humiliation, this guy could have killed him. And he hadn't. "Part of what I do these days is work with a woman," he said softly, "Danny Cafferty. Her father owned a shop, and I worked with him until his death. And now Danny and I collect things. Unusual things. Angus Cafferty was a real scholar, and in his business, he needed to know about history and things."
"Things?"
"Curiosities of evil," Quinn said. "Believe me or not, objects that are cursed or that create evil in those who know how to use them or seek power through them. And I have a feeling now that we're not dealing with any film project. We're dealing with a thing that can cause evil." Quinn waited for the other man, Jack, to tell him he was crazy. Jack didn't say any such thing. Instead, "What about this Madame de Medici he mentioned?"
She's another notorious collector, but the way this is going, I doubt she knows anything. Just a red herring in the story Chastain concocted for you.
Jack took the bracelet and held it up, turning it this way and that in the wan moonlight filtering through the stained glass.
Valuable? Priceless might be a better word. It's one of a kind. Supposedly one of the seven infernals.
He saw Jack stiffen.
An infernal? He shoved it back into Quinn's hands. Here.
You know of the infernals?
Unfortunately, yeah. Met one.
Something in his expression said it had been a harrowing encounter. Jack hadn't doubted Quinn, and Quinn didn't doubt Jack for a minute.
But hardly anybody's even heard of the infernals, even Danny.
Danny, your partner who collects things?
Her shop is called the Cheshire Cat. It's on Royal Street. She sells art, jewelry, and innocent collectibles. And she has a separate collection of things in the basement which will never be sold.
He hesitated.
We also destroy things when they need destroying. And when there are things out there that might cause violence or havoc, people sometimes come to her or the Cheshire Cat.
He shrugged. We work together most of the time. She had to be at a ceremony with a friend of ours, a voodoo priestess.
So you're moonlighting on your own.
Quinn cast Jack a sharp glance.
That's kind of what you're doing, isn't it?
This is how I make my living, just not so far from home.
Quinn continued with, the upper half of the scroll Chastain bought with the bracelet was copied before it was stolen. That copy and the original of the bottom half of the scroll were left to Danny on consignment.
Who left it?
Some weird old guy, wouldn't leave his name. Said he'd be back after she sold it. There didn't seem to be anything, well, not right about it.
He hesitated and then said, we usually have a nose for things that aren't right.
He trusted her?
Quinn shrugged, hiding a burst of pride.
She has a flawless reputation.
Any buyer?
Quinn felt a mild jolt of unease as he remembered Danny mentioning that she had sold the fragment and to whom she had sold it.
Yes, Madame de Medici.
I thought you didn't know the woman, Jack said sharply.
I don't know her. I know of her. She doesn't come into the shop herself. She sends a minion.
Jack laughed. Minion? She's got a minion?
A number of them. Anyway, she's purchased from Danny before, and nothing bad has ever come of it.
So she does figure in this.
What the hell, maybe.
But I still think Chastain is taking the two of us on some kind of a ride.
We'll worry about Madame de Medici later, Jack said, pointing to the bracelet.
What's the deal on this thing?
The top half of the scroll claims the Cid Sev Nolesso confers the gift of knowing the thoughts of others. No one can hide their thoughts from the wearer.
I can see where that could come in handy during a negotiation. For a collector like Chastain, who's always haggling, it's invaluable.
What's the downside?
Quinn was surprised by the question.
Why do you think there's a downside? He felt uneasy.
They should have sensed something bad was going to go down.
Always a downside with an infernal.
How can you know that?
Supposedly, there are seven infernals. One of them damn near took the two people who mean more to me than anything else in this world.
How?
Too long a story for here and now.
Okay. Where is it now?
Gone. And don't ask where, because I don't know. But it didn't go alone. It took somebody with it.
From Jack's expression, Quinn knew better than to ask who.
Jack cleared his throat and said,
Enough about me. What's the bottom half of the scroll say?
It says the bracelet isn't of Greek or Egyptian origin. Calls it one of the seven infernals from the First Age.
I obviously don't have to explain that to you.
But its gift is considered a curse. So maybe that's your downside.
Jack shook his head.
If you know someone's thoughts, they can't hide anything from you.
The truth can be ugly and it can hurt, but knowing what's really going down is better than getting the shaft.
Quinn couldn't disagree. The advantage in any relationship, business or personal, was obvious.
But either way, Jack said, why the hell are we here?
According to the scroll, the Sidsev Nalesso, like all seven infernals, must be triggered to work.
Jack's expression was bleak. Yeah, I know.
Quinn wondered just what the hell had happened to him.
He held up the bracelet.
Well, this one requires violence to activate it.
So, there you have it. That's why we're here.
Was I actually supposed to kill you?
The scroll says death isn't necessary, just violence.
Jack began wandering in a tight circle, muttering, curse. No one can hide their thoughts from the wearer. Violence.
Suddenly, Jack whirled and punched him in the gut. Quinn doubled over, as much in surprise as in pain.
Are you out of your...
A right cross to the jaw snapped his head back.
That did it. If this son of a bitch wanted a Donnybrook, he was going to get one.
Quinn charged, head down, catching Jack in the midsection and slamming him back against the shelves.
You son of a bitch! Jack gasped in a breathless voice,
and then he grabbed Quinn's arm and flipped him on his ass.
Oh, hell, Quinn thought, rolling and leaping to his feet.
But he was smiling as he charged at Jack.
Is it going as you hoped? Said a soft, feminine voice behind him.
Jules Chastain whirled, then relaxed. Even in the meager light, he recognized Madame de Medici. He had found a vantage point 50 yards from his family mausoleum and had settled in to see if the seeds he had planted bore violent fruit. How had she found him?
Not quiet. And why are you here?
As an involved party.
I have a right, yes?
He had been trying to place her accent in the years since she'd appeared in New Orleans, but it remained elusive.
You recommended the New York mercenary, nothing more.
She said she had heard of a so-called repairman Jack who hired himself out to fix situations. She had assured Jules he was real and reliable, though known to have a violent streak. She'd even passed along his number. Jules had liked the violent streak aspect and had hired Michael Quinn as cannon fodder. Everyone in New Orleans knew not to mess with Quinn. The two made for a combustible combination. She focused her amber gaze on him.
But I have an interest in the Sidsev Nalesso as well. After all, I used to own it.
Those eyes. One could almost fall into them, could almost believe she really had lived for millennia. But Jules chose to humor her rather than challenge her. The Sidsev Nalesso had been found in Heraklion, which had sunk in the 3rd century BC. The idea of Madame de Medici once having owned that bracelet was beyond delusional, more like psychotic. So never challenge a psycho.
I hope you're not thinking of trying anything sneaky here,
Dear Jules, the idea never crossed my mind. I will be quite happy to see it on your wrist. I lost it in a civil upheaval. Where it lands after that is up to fate.
Whatever happened to the Sidsev Nalesso, dear lady, it landed with me.
He had made up that story for Jack about stealing it from her. Quite clever, he thought. But he had bought it fair and square on the black market. It was his.
God, she was beautiful. She had emigrated from Cairo during the so-called Arab Spring and wound up in New Orleans with a trove of antiquities. She tended to dress in gauzy fabrics that covered everything and hid nothing. He'd asked her to dinner 100 times, but she had refused. "I'm not looking for a relationship," was her eternal excuse. "Neither am I, dear lady. I wish only one night with you."
He jumped at the sound of gunfire echoing from the mausoleum.
"Ah," he said, "now I am happy." "It should be activated now," she said, turning and sauntering away. "Don't forget, put it on right away, or it will lose power."
He bit back a laugh. So convincing. He made himself comfortable and waited until the police and the ambulance arrived. He watched the EMTs carry Just Jack out on a stretcher, with Michael Quinn walking behind. Both alive? Quel dommage. He hoped death wasn't required to trigger the bracelet. When all the intruders were gone, Jules made his way to the mausoleum and slipped through the still-open front gates. He headed to the rear of the altar and pried up the tile. A little digging, and there it was, the Sidsev Nalesso. He noted with glee that its stone had turned from green to red, confirmation that the bracelet's power had been ignited. He sighed. "You are such a genius, Jules." He slipped it over his left hand and was taken aback when it tightened itself around his wrist, but not too tight. Okay, not a problem. Custom fit wasn't a bad thing, and he had no intention of taking it off anyway. If this trinket lived up to only a fraction of its advance publicity, the world would be his oyster. As he stepped out into the night, he heard a voice.
$2. Need $1 more to get a bottle. Small bottle, but better than nothing."
He looked around and saw a wino stumbling past the Boudreaux vault. His first thought was to drive out the trespasser, but then he realized the bum wasn't talking. Jules was hearing him in his head, hearing his thoughts. Dear God, it worked. It worked! Other thoughts streamed in. "Another drink and she'll be ready. Oh, I hope I don't hurl. I'll totally die if I hurl." A young couple out for the night? He wondered where they were. But further speculation was cut off by more voices in his head. "Shout, it was over." Jim greatly alarmed me from the deepest reproach, as if it were soon. All the other company. "I never thought he would. My convict. Do you mean that? But that it wasn't tomorrow. But the style I had best endeavors. Let to see him next day. When living had a but he had no time after. And apparently out. Old chap. Found the file still in—" He pressed his hands to his ears but couldn't stop the voices, the thoughts from other heads streaming in from all over the city, the state, the county, the world, mixing and interweaving into a mad torrent that ran straight into his consciousness. Stop! He screamed.
But it didn't stop. It thickened and quickened and ran more furiously into his brain.
Turns of yours, this question.
Mais est-il que j'ai mieux ce force de léser?
Burns that dread serious subcutaneous sickness of
Musel podjedjets je viem je nedvit mitjernik.
Us and arms may coil, must grunt.
Wir würde mit einen guten Namen sicher glücklich.
Cutaneous frothy takes the good. Wasn't myself might have a life and the muscle to heartache if a...
He clawed at the bracelet, but it wouldn't fit over his hand. He pushed at it, digging its edge into his skin, drawing blood, but it was too tight to remove. Too tight! He had to get it off!
Jules Chastain ran screaming through the night in search of help.
The ambulance pulled up in front of the emergency entrance at Tulane Medical Center. Jack sat up and looked at the EMT at his side. Thanks for the lift.
Hey, no worries, the young man told him. Quinn called. That's enough for me.
Good guy to know, this Michael Quinn. As Jack exited the vehicle, a car pulled up behind it. Quinn sat behind the wheel. Jack nodded as he slipped into the passenger's seat. Quinn rubbed his jaw before driving out into traffic.
That's one mean right hook you have.
Jack said, you're no slouch yourself. My ribs are bruised to shit. Quinn laughed. I'm glad I saw that green stone turn red when it did. It's going to be hard enough explaining. Well, hell, I think we're both beat up enough.
Seemed the right thing to do, letting Chastain get in there and take the bracelet after we activated it, Jack said. If there really is a curse, then the man deserved to have it.
Quinn offered him a grim smile.
I hope you're right about this, right about the way the curse will work.
Jack's own experience with an infernal had come to a tragic end, but it could have been so much worse. They weren't called infernals for nothing.
I'm just guessing, he said. No one can hide their thoughts from the wearer, could also read everyone's thoughts are revealed to the wearer.
And hearing literally everyone's thoughts would definitely be a curse.
Nice touch, Quinn told him. I mean, firing your Glock into the floor after our fight, and reburying that bracelet so that Chastain could find it once we were out.
Not a bad deal that you're friends with half the cops and emergency techs in the city, too.
Quinn shrugged. Well, like I told you, I was a cop once.
Still work with them, with one great cop, an old partner, LaRue. He doesn't want me to explain things like curses and infernals. He just wants me to take care of them.
I tend to avoid cops. Nothing personal. It's just the less they know about me, the better.
You have warrants out on you? Jack shrugged.
Need a name on a warrant, don't you?
Yeah, of course.
Well then, I guess not. As for the here and now, we should know how things pan out by tomorrow. You know a place I can bunk for the night?
Quinn smiled, not at all grimly then.
Yeah, I know a great place, right on Royal. And when Danny wants to know why I'm beat to hell, I can say, you should see the other guy, and then show her that other guy.
Jack laughed. He could get to like this Quinn. It didn't take long to reach the center of the French Quarter. Jack was impressed with the historic building with the sign that read, The Cheshire Cat. But they didn't enter by the front. Quinn hit a button on his dash, a garage door opened, and they moved through a beautiful garden courtyard to enter by a side door. A woman was waiting there, tall and lithe, with a giant dog by her side.
That's just Wolf, Quinn told him, greeting the dog
who accepted Jack right away because his master suggested he do so. Quinn seemed a little awkward as he greeted the woman.
"Danny, you're back early."
"So I am," she said, staring from Quinn to Jack and then back at Quinn again. "I guess you two should come in and get cleaned up and patched up. And I guess you're going to tell me that I should see the other guys?"
Jack looked at Quinn. They both smiled. Jack said, "We are the other guys."
"Interesting," Danny said. "I'll put on some tea and get out the whiskey. I'm looking forward to hearing all about it."
Normally, Jack would be looking for a beer, but after tonight, whiskey was definitely in order.
In the morning, Quinn tracked down LaRue by phone and learned he was at the hospital. He rounded up Jack and drove him there. The front desk gave them the room number and they headed up. No surprise to find his old friend standing next to the bed where Chastain lay heavily sedated. His left arm was thickly bandaged, and Quinn noticed with a start it was much shorter than it should be.
"Quinn," LaRue said, shaking his head. "I guess I expected to see you here at some point. Damnedest thing. Chastain, he of untold riches, suddenly went mad and cut off his own hand. You know anything about that? And who's your friend?"
"Jack. Jack, this is Detective LaRue."
"Jack?" "Just Jack."
LaRue studied him a moment, then shrugged. "Anything I need to worry about?" he asked Quinn. Quinn stared at the pale, unconscious man.
"He's gonna make it?"
"Minus his hand and wrist."
"How did he wind up here?"
"He's lucky he's alive. Beat cop found him wandering the streets, mumbling incoherently. I was afraid we had a psycho out there somewhere chopping on people. But according to the EMT who worked with him first, Chastain said he cut his own hand off because it had betrayed him. Not sure what the hell that means. Bastard wasn't even drunk or on anything. Tox reports came back clean."
"Anybody find the hand?"
LaRue shook his head. "Gone. Dog might have run off with it, or a big rat."
"How about some jewelry?" Jack said. "Like, oh, say, a bracelet?"
LaRue stared at them both.
"What bracelet?"
Hell, that meant the Sid Sev Nalesso was still out there.
Quinn shrugged and said, "Well, I was just thinking, if you cut your hand off at the wrist, it might have been because you had something on the wrist that you couldn't get off. You know, something that had betrayed you."
"I got cops looking in dumpsters, no hand," LaRue said. "Strange as hell, huh? Should I be looking for a bracelet?"
"If you find the hand, you'll find something with it, I would think," Quinn said. LaRue shook his head and glanced at both men.
"You make sure I know if there's something I should be worrying about, Quinn. Mr. Jack, enjoy the city."
LaRue walked by them. Quinn watched as Jack paused at Chastain's bedside.
"What goes around?" he murmured.
Quinn nodded.
"No one dead. That works for me."
And he now realized why he had sensed nothing wrong about the bracelet. There hadn't been anything wrong until it was activated. Jack said, "Where the hell do you think the hand and bracelet could be?" Quinn had an idea, but kept it to himself.
"Need a ride to the airport?"
Jack shook his head. "The TSA and I aren't on cordial terms." Now, that was interesting.
"Well, I'm afraid I don't have a private jet on hand like Chastain."
"Didn't figure you did. Guess I'll rent a car."
Quinn figured that meant whatever ID Jack was carrying was bogus. "So your ID's good enough for Hertz, but not TSA?"
Jack gave him a long look before shrugging. It's passed TSA before, but I'm not one for tempting fate.
Long drive.
Jack sighed. Can't say I'm looking forward to it, but I guess it's a way to see some country.
I take it you don't leave New York much.
Jack shrugged. What for?
Quinn had to laugh. He felt the same about New Orleans.
Traffic was light. 30 minutes later, Quinn dropped Jack at the airport Hertz office.
If you're ever in New Orleans again, Quinn said.
Jack shook his hand.
Don't hold your breath.
Madame de' Medici stood without moving, admiring the Sidsev Nalesso. It remained clamped around Jules Chastain's flesh where his hand, wrist, and distal forearm lay on a metal tray in her private museum. She had told Jules last night that she'd be quite happy to see it on his wrist, and that had been true. In fact, she would always see it there. Chastain's extremity had to be properly preserved, of course. She knew the ancient ways of curing flesh. After that, she would place the ensemble in the glass display case she had prepared for it.
She was not tempted to wear it, not in the least. She was no fool. But she was delighted to have it back in her collection.
She smoothed back a length of elegant dark hair, quite satisfied for the moment. Chastain had wanted the Sidsev Nalesso so badly. Now he would wear it. Forever.
Raymond Corey versus Linwood Barclay. Raymond Corey's decision to use Sean Riley for the short story was an easy one. He'd first brought the FBI agent to life when, in 1996, as a budding screenwriter, he'd written his third, unproduced screenplay, a modern conspiracy thriller that harkened back to the days of the Crusades, called The Last Templar. He then experienced the euphoria of being offered a small fortune by a major New York publisher to turn his screenplay into a novel, only then to be gutted when the publisher said they'd like him to make a small change to the story. Let's lose the religion. It's boring. Turn the Templar secret into gold, jewels, a real treasure. Raymond decided that advice was no good, so he nixed the deal. Smart, gutsy, foolish? Maybe all three. But interest in the screenplay did trigger a screenwriting career. So, for several years, Sean Riley remained locked away in a dormant file on Raymond's hard drive while he worked on movies and television shows. Then, in 2006, Sean Riley was finally allowed to breathe again in The Last Templar. Raymond decided to write the story for himself, religion and all. The result was a global success, selling over 5 million copies in more than 40 languages. Which just goes to show, not all advice is good advice. For Linwood Barclay, the decision to use Glenn Garber was a little trickier. Linwood hasn't had a series character since he wrote 4 comic thrillers, from 2004 to 2007, starring Zach Walker. Since then, each of his novels has been a standalone with a different hero. The obsessive-compulsive, risk-averse Zach Walker would not have been the best partner for Sean Riley. Zach would have probably fled the story after the first paragraph, leaving Riley to carry the load. But Glenn Garber, the contractor, as in home renovator, not hitman, from Linwood's The Accident, 2011, seemed the perfect character to team with Riley. He's a tough, no-nonsense guy, someone who's not unfamiliar with loss and not afraid to put himself on the line to protect those he loves. While he doesn't have the kind of training Sean Riley possesses, he's no stranger to courage and wanting to see justice done. This short story emerged from a single line that Linwood emailed to Raymond, which ultimately became the fiery incident that launches the tale. Both writers then batted the story back and forth, each writing one of the sections and seeding clues, while leaving the choice of where to go entirely to the other. The result? A free flow of imagination and an exhilarating ride.
pit stop. Glenn Garber had been given his coffee but was still waiting for an order of chicken nuggets for his daughter Kelly when a woman raced into the restaurant screaming that some guy was on fire in the parking lot. They'd pulled in off the interstate at around the halfway point of their trip. Glenn was being asked to bid on a farmhouse renovation about 2 hours out of Milford. It was Saturday, so he invited Kelly to come along for the ride, not just because he liked her company, but because he wasn't going to leave a 10-year-old on her own for the day. Glenn had been paranoid enough when his wife Sheila was still alive, but being a single dad had upped his anxiety levels. He always wanted to know where Kelly was, every minute of every day. He could just imagine how much she'd appreciate this when she was well into her teenage years. When Kelly saw the signs for an upcoming service center, she announced that she was so hungry she thought she might die. "We wouldn't want that," her father said. "I guess I could use a coffee. I'll make a quick pit stop." Turned out not to be so quick. Given that it was Saturday and the middle of summer, the lot was packed, and the lineup deep when they went into the restaurant. When they finally reached the counter, Glenn placed their order. The girl ringing up the sale said the nuggets would take a few minutes, but she had his coffee to him in seconds. Glenn wrapped his hand around the takeout cup and quickly let go. "Yikes," he said. "We'll be up there before this is cool enough to drink." He put the tip of his index finger on the bottom lip and his thumb on the edge of the plastic lid. "Where's my nuggets?" Kelly asked. The girl said they'd just take a... That was when the woman screamed, "He's on fire! There's a man on fire!" The first thing Glenn thought was, no way, a car on fire, maybe. Wasn't unheard of for a car to overheat here along the interstate, especially when it was pushing 90 degrees out there. But a man in flames? That didn't sound right. The second thing he thought was, he had a fire extinguisher in his pickup, a Ford F-150 with the words Garber Contracting, Milford, plastered on the doors. Should he run out, grab the extinguisher from behind the driver's seat, and try to help this guy, assuming what this woman said was true? Yeah, maybe, except he wasn't about to leave Kelly all by herself in a crowded roadside fast food joint where someone could grab a kid, toss her in a car, and be God knows where in 10 minutes. "Honey," he said to her, "we're going to the truck." "What about my..." But by the way her dad pulled her arm, she knew something bad was going on. She hadn't only heard the woman screaming about that guy, she could feel the anxiety sweeping the room. People trying to decide what to do, whether to stay in there, flock to the window and gawk, or run outside and get a front row seat. Glenn guided Kelly quickly to the door, pushing past people, butting in ahead of them to get outside. Coming out of the air conditioning, the midday heat hit them like a warm, smothering blanket. "Over there," Kelly said, pointing. A crowd had formed a couple of car lengths away from the pumps. Waves of heat riffled through the air. Glenn let go of Kelly's arm, reached into his pocket for the remote, and hit the button to unlock his truck as they approached it. He brought Kelly around to the passenger side. She was more than big enough to hop in herself, but her father gave her enough of a boost that she was nearly tossed across the seat. He reached over her and placed his coffee into one of the cup holders between the seats. Then he went around to the driver's side, opened the door, and reached behind the seat to grab the red cylinder he always kept there. Doing construction, you were just as likely to need one of these at a work site as you were to put out a car fire. "Stay here," Glenn said firmly. "Lock the doors." "I'll die with the windows up," Kelly said. "It's 1,000,000 degrees in here." He hopped in long enough to engage the ignition without firing up the engine and power down the windows, leaving the key inserted in the steering column. "Keep the doors locked just the same." Glenn, extinguisher in his right hand, ran toward the commotion. People screaming. He pulled the pin on the extinguisher, then got his left hand under the cylinder for support and shouldered his way through the onlookers. Good God. It was hard to tell with the flames, but it was indeed a man. In his 30s, probably, maybe 250 pounds, dressed in sandals and a t-shirt and a pair of those cargo shorts with the oversized pockets. Not exactly a Tibetan monk setting himself ablaze. If the man had been flailing earlier, he'd given up by the time Glenn had arrived, now down on the pavement, his body crumpling in on itself as the flames consumed him. But that didn't stop Glenn from taking a few quick shots with the extinguisher. The people who'd gathered around backed away, mouths still open in horror. But a couple of them had screamed and shifted their gaze to something else and were looking no less shocked. Glenn managed to tear his eyes away from the dead man to see what could possibly be distracting these people from a sight as ghastly as this. It wasn't exactly every day you came upon a man on fire. A man was staggering out of the men's room, which was off on one side of the restaurant. He had blood across his face and held one hand against his temple, and was teetering unsteadily on his feet, barely able to walk. But even from this far, Glenn could make out a fierce determination in the man's face. He didn't have too much time to dwell on it. The next thing he heard wrenched his heart out and squeezed the life out of it. It was a sound he was well familiar with. The starter drive of a Ford F-150. His Ford F-150. He snapped his gaze away from the injured man in time to see his truck charge out of its parking spot and roar off in the direction of the interstate. Sean Riley couldn't see clearly. His eyes weren't functioning properly. Not yet, not with the blood streaked across them, and the little information they were filtering in was being processed by a concussed brain. A direct hit from a toilet tank cover usually had that effect. He glanced around as he advanced, willing his head to clear up, trying to process whatever inputs he could pick up from the scene around him. He could make out a small crowd gathered off to his left. He could hear panicked screams and sobbing coming from them. And then the smell hit him, a horrific smell that he instantly recognized, a putrid, sickly, sweet smell that was unique and traumatizing to anyone who'd ever suffered the misfortune of coming across it. Mercifully, most people hadn't. Then again, most people weren't FBI field agents for whom the worst horrors the human mind could dream up were just part and parcel of the job. Riley saw the rising smoke and instantly guessed what must have happened there. He also knew who had to be responsible for it, the same man who had left him for dead in the men's toilet. And as anger spiked through him from that realization and morsels of clarity tumbled into his mind, he heard a man yelling out, "Kelly!" He saw a man burst out from among the crowd and charge off across the lot, chucking a fire extinguisher he was carrying. Riley's instinct shifted all his attention away from the crowd and locked onto that man, and he willed his legs to propel him faster as he chased after him. The man stopped by a row of parked cars that were lined up outside the restaurant and again screamed out the name, a reverberating scream that seemed to emanate from the very pit of his soul. He was glancing ahead down the interstate, then his head darted left and right as Riley caught up with him. The man must have heard and sensed Riley. He spun around to face him, one arm raised high, its fist balled offensively and ready to pummel. "My daughter," he growled, his face burning with fear and fury. "She's gone." Riley raised his hands defensively. "Wait a sec. Kelly," the man hollered again. "My girl, she was in my truck. It was right here and now it's gone, heading for the highway." Riley understood. First, another innocent victim burned alive. A distraction, Riley figured, to allow the man he was after to get away. Now this. This guy's daughter abducted. All because of him. His own fury took over. "It was locked," the man spat out as he shot another glance down the highway, "but the key was in it. The windows were down." Riley held both hands in front of him, his fingers splayed open in a holding, calming gesture. "You have a phone?" he asked the girl's father. The man seemed momentarily confused by this. "What? Do you have a phone on you?" The man nodded and patted his